So we start this second session with the development of aspirational bodhicitta, followed by receiving the bodhisattva vow. And both of this vow and minds will be generated by repeating words. And as most of you are already aware, first, in order to cultivate such altruistic mind, we will purify negative deeds and accumulate virtue by practicing the seven limb prayers. And generally speaking, the three objects of refuge, they are always present. So if you are someone who has a good understanding of these qualities of these three objects of refuge, and then it really doesn't matter whether you specifically invite them or not, they are always there. But then in the case of those people who have no understanding and idea, then even if you continue reciting many elaborate prayers, it will not make much impact in your mind. So therefore, without resorting to recitation of long prayers, we'll develop this altruistic mind and receive the bodhisattva vow. And so here you should reflect on the Buddha's of the past, and similarly those that are engaging in the ways of life of bodhisattva right now. So all the bodhisattvas, and particularly those who are Aryas or who are on the superior path. And in order to remind you these facts, imagine that in front of you the actual Buddha with major and minor signs are there. And then, as is depicted in the supplication to the 17 Nalanda scholars, recollect all these great Nalanda scholars, Nalanda masters, who had contributed much to the preservation and the flourishment of Buddha's teaching. And even though more than thousands of years have passed, still their works, their texts are benefiting countless people. And therefore, even though their grosser physical body is no more present before us, but it is sure that their compassionate mind is still engaging in us, and their omniscient mind is knowing us. And likewise, recall the great masters from Tibet, like the 25 close disciples, and likewise great highly accomplished masters and the great translators, and who had immensely contributed to the teaching of the Buddha. And recall the masters from the ancient Nyingma tradition, and masters and lineage masters from the Lamde of the Sakya, and then Marwa, Milarepa, and so on, of the Khajiit lineage, the root and lineage lamas. And likewise, imagine the presence of Tsongkhapa, Jasabje, Kidubje, and the masters from the new transmission. New transmission lineage. And likewise, visualize the presence of all the guardians of the virtuous deeds. And even today we can read their texts, and we can contemplate and think. And the little amount of transformation and change of the mind that we have done today, or we have achieved today, is due to the guidance and teaching of these great masters. Imagine that all these great masters are there in front of me. And if you reflect either on the qualities of compassion or omniscience of this master, there is every reason to develop genuine respect and recall their kindnesses, and therefore and also reflect how this great master were able to develop such levels of having eliminated the negative deeds, and how they were able to achieve such a state of realization and knowledge. They were able to achieve such a state of enlightenment in relation to development of loving kindness, compassion, and so on to the suffering sentient beings. And likewise, in our case, we must endeavor to benefit all these suffering sentient beings who are like oneself, wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, and also reflect on the nature, how these sentient beings wanting happiness are deprived of happiness, and how these sentient beings that do not desire suffering are full of suffering, and thereby develop loving kindness and compassion in relation to these sentient beings, and faith and devotion towards the objects of refuge, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And at this point, imagine the presence of all these great masters in front of you as a witness that you are developing this expressional bodhicitta and making this commitment, and also visualize the presence of all sentient beings around you, and you are making this commitment in the presence of all the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and Lamas. And in this way, you should develop the altruistic wish to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And then you should think that I will never give up this mind. So that is called generation of aspirational bodhicitta with commitment. And with regard to the actual actualization of enlightenment, unless you actually live and lead the ways of life of bodhisattva, it is not possible to actualize such state of enlightenment simply by developing such an aspirational mind. So the very purpose of development of such an aspirational bodhicitta and the purpose of making such a commitment is so that you are able to lead the actual ways of life of bodhisattva that leads to the actualization of the state of Buddhahood. And so with regard to actualization of Buddhahood, apart from leading the ways of life of a bodhisattva, there is no other way, whether it is in the case of the Buddhas of the past, or Buddhas of the present, or Buddhas of the future. The only way to achieve enlightenment is by developing such an altruistic wish and leading the ways of life of a bodhisattva. and also realize how fortunate we are to get such an opportunity to develop such a mind. And even in the case of the Tibetans, even though we have lost our country, and that way we are experiencing much difficulties, but still we are fortunate to have such an opportunity to sit down, to reflect, and to meditate on such an altruistic wish. So therefore we should all make the commitment that I will develop such a mind and make my life meaningful. And therefore it is this kind of practices which is really directly beneficial to oneself and to all others. And apart from such practices, other practices like visualizing oneself as a deity and so on, it is really not sure whether this will be beneficial or not. And on the other hand, when you commit yourself and endeavor to develop such a mind, then at least there will be some change in your attitude, in your mind. So it is this kind of practices like development of altruism which really grants real accomplishment in your hand. And therefore the great Kadamba masters used to say that even though everybody has a deity to visualize and everyone has a mantra to recite, but nothing has changed their mind because they are really deprived of the actual religious practice. And in the case of receiving certain initiations, we are all fond of rushing to receive an initiation. After receiving initiation, you may do certain recitations, but unless you meditate on loving kindness, compassion and altruism, you will not be able to change your mind. And with regard to these practices, like development of loving kindness, compassion and altruism, even if you repeat and follow some other people's practices, it will have its own impact. Now, particularly in the case of those of you who are relatively younger, in your case still, the majority of your life is still yet to go, and therefore you should endeavor and you can really make your life meaningful. And even in the case of those who had reached half of their age, you should dedicate that you will make the rest of your life meaningful. And then there are others who are of same age like myself, then in our case more than two-thirds of the life has been passed. Here also we should make determination that we'll spend the rest of life in such a meaningful practices. And even if you are someone who may not have many years to live, but still you should dedicate the rest of the few years to undertake altruistic practice. And even if you want to be born as a Tibetan in the future lives, then you should undertake this kind of altruism and then dedicate it. And then that will, I think, ensure your birth as a Tibetan who is able to undertake genuine practice. And so if you undertake such a practice, then right from the childhood you will be one who will be kind, compassionate, and not a child who is fond of killing the insects and so on. And in terms of actual development of bodhicitta, it is not an easy task, so it is even possible that we might take many lives or countless eons. But if we make a start, then that will bring us closer and closer to the development of such a mind. And therefore you should think that I will adopt the ways of life of the Bodhisattvas. And with regard to the adoption of the ways of life of a Bodhisattva, it should not be the case that you will practice and adopt them only when you have the time or when you are in a good mood, and to forget them when you are rushed or when you do not feel like developing them. So we'll recite a few lines from the Bodhicharyavatara. Chapter. And then we'll continue reciting. I think the whole second chapter, and then few verses from the third chapter as well. So we'll recite this together. And in order to see the precious mind, I offer now to the Tathagatas, to the sacred Dharma, the stainless jewel, and to the sons of the Buddha, the oceans of excellence. Whatever flowers and fruit there are, and whatever kinds of medicine, whatever jewels exist in this world, and whatever clean, refreshing waters. Likewise, gem-encrusted mountains, forest groves, quiet and joyful places, heavenly trees bedecked with flowers, and trees with fruit-laden branches. Fragrances of the celestial realms, incense, wishing trees and jewel trees, uncultivated harvests and ornaments, that are lovely, that are worthy to be offered, lakes and pools adorned with lotuses, and the beautiful cry of wild geese, everything unowned within the limitless spheres of space. Creating these things in my mind, I offer them to the Supreme Beings, the Buddhas, as well as their sons. O compassionate ones, think kindly of me and accept these offerings of mine. Having no merit, I am destitute, and I have no other gifts to offer. O protectors, you who think of helping others, by your power accept these for my sake. Eternally shall I offer all my bodies to the conquerors and their sons. Please accept me, your supreme heroes. Respectfully shall I be of your subject. Through being completely under your care, I shall benefit all with no fears of conditioned existence. I shall perfectly transcend my previous evils, and in the future shall commit no more. To very sweetly scented bathing chambers with brilliantly sparkling crystal floors and exquisite pillars ablaze with gems, having canopies above aglow with pearls, I beseech the Tathagatas and their sons to come and bathe their bodies from many jeweled vases filled with water scented and enticing to the accompaniment of music and song. Let me dry their bodies with incomparable cloths, clean and well anointed with scent, and then may I present these holy beings with fragrant garments of suitable colors. I adorn with manifold ornaments and various raiments fine and smooth the Aryas, Samantabhadra, Manju Gosha, Avalokiteshvara, and all the others. Just like polishing pure refined gold, do I anoint the Buddha's forms that ablaze with light, with the choicest perfumes, whose fragrance permeates 1,000,000,000 volts. And to the highest objects of giving, I offer beautiful well-arranged garlands, as well as enchanting sweet-smelling flowers, such as lily, jasmine, and lotus blossoms. Also I send forth clouds of incense, whose sweet aroma seals away the mind, as well as celestial delicacies, including a variety of foods and drinks. I offer them jeweled lamps arranged on golden lotus buds. Upon land sprinkled with scented water, do I scatter delicate flower petals. To those who have the nature of compassion, I offer palaces resounding with melodious hymns, exquisitely illuminated by hanging pearls and gems that adorn the infinites of space. Eternally shall I offer to all the Buddhas jeweled umbrellas with golden handles and exquisite ornaments embellishing the rims, standing erect, their shapes beautiful to behold. And in addition, may a mass of offerings, resounding with sweet and pleasing music, like clouds that appease the misery fall, each remain for as long as necessary. And may a continuous rain of flowers and precious gems descend upon the reliquaries and the statues, and upon all the jewels of Dharma, in the same way as Manju Gosha and others have made offerings to the conquerors. Similarly, do I bestow gifts upon the Tathagatas, the protectors, their sons, and all. I glorify the oceans of excellence with limitless verses of harmonious praise. May the clouds of gentle eulogy constantly ascend to their presence, with bodies as numerous as all the atoms within the universe. I prostrate to all Buddhas of the three times, the Dharma, and the Supreme Community. Likewise, I prostrate to all reliquaries, to the basis of an awakening mind, to all learned abbots and masters, and to all the noble practitioners. I seek refuge in all Buddhas until I possess the essence of awakening. Likewise, I seek refuge in Dharma and in the assembly of Bodhisattvas. With folded hands, I beseech the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, who possess the great compassion, and reside in all directions. Throughout beginningless cycle existence, in this life and in others, unknowingly I committed evil deeds and ordered them to be done by others. Overwhelmed by the deceptions of ignorance, I rejoiced in what was done. But now seeing these mistakes, from my heart I declare them to the Buddhas. Whatever harmful acts of body, speech and mind I have done in a disturbed mental state towards the three jewels of refuge, my parents, my spiritual masters and others, and all the grave wrongs done by me, so thoroughly evil and polluted, but an abundance of faults, I openly declare to the guides of the world. But I may well perish before all my evils have been purified. So please protect me in such a way as will swiftly and surely free me from them. The untrustworthy Lord of Death waits not for things to be done or undone. Whether I am sick or healthy, this fleeting lifespan is unstable. Leaving all, I must depart alone. But through not having understood this, I committed various kinds of evil for the sake of my friends and foes. My foes will become nothing. My friends will become nothing. I too will become nothing. Likewise, all will become nothing. Just like a dream experience, whatever things I enjoy will become a memory. Whatever has passed will not be seen again. Even within this brief life, many friends and foes have passed. But whatever unbearable evil I committed for them remains ahead of me. Thereby, through not having realized that I shall suddenly vanish, I committed so much evil out of ignorance, lust and hate, remaining neither day nor night. Life is always slipping by and never getting any longer. Why will death not come to one like me? While I am lying in bed, although surrounded by my friends and relatives, the feeling of life being severed will be experienced by me alone when seized by the messengers of death. What benefit will friends and relatives afford? My merit alone shall protect me then, but upon that I have never relied. O protectors, I, so unconcerned, unaware of such terror as this, accumulated a great deal of evil for the sake of this transient life. Petrified is the person today being led to a torture chamber with dry mouth and dreadful sunken eyes. His entire appearance is transfigured. One need to mention the tremendous despair when stricken with the disease of great panic, being clasped by the physical forms of the frightful messengers of death. Who can afford me real protection from this great horror? With terrified, bulging eyes agape, I shall search in four directions for refuge. But seeing no refuge there, I shall become enveloped in gloom. If there should be no protection there, then what shall I be able to do? Therefore I now seek refuge to the Buddhas who protect the world, who strive to shelter all that lives, and with great strength eradicate all fear. Likewise, I purely seek refuge in the Dharma they have realized, that clears away the fears of cycle existence, and also in the assembly of Bodhisattvas. I, trembling with fear, offer myself to Samantabhadra, to Manju Gosha also, I make a gift of my body, to the protector of Lokiteshvara, who infallibly acts with compassion. I utter a mournful cry, please protect this evildoer. In my search for refuge, I cry from my heart for Akash Garba, Shethi Garba, and all the compassionate protectors. And I seek refuge in Vajrapani, upon the sight of whom all harmful beings, such as the messengers of death, flee in terror to the four quarters. Previously, I transgressed your advice, but now upon seeing this great fear, I go to you for refuge. By doing so, may this fear be swiftly cleared away. If I need to comply with the doctor's advice when frightened by a common illness, then how much more so when perpetually diseased by the manifold evils of desire and so forth. And if all people dwelling on this earth can be overcome by just one of these, and if no other medicine to cure them, is to be found elsewhere in the universe. Then the intention not to act in accordance with the advice of all of the all-knowing physicians that can uproot every misery is extremely bewildered and worthy of scorn. If I need to be careful near a small ordinary precipice, then how much more so near the one of long duration that drops for 1,000 miles. It is inappropriate to enjoy myself thinking that today alone I shall not die, for inevitably the time will come when I shall become nothing. Who can grant me fearlessness? How can I be surely freed from this? If I shall inevitably become nothing, how can I relax and enjoy myself? What remains with me now from the terminated experience of the past? But through my great attachment to them, I have been going against my spiritual master's advice. Having departed from this life and from all my relatives and friends, if all alone I must go elsewhere, what is the use of making friends and enemies? How can I be surely freed from unwholesomeness, the source of misery, continually, night and day? Should I only consider this? Whatever has been done by me through ignorance and unknowing, be it the breaking of a vow or a deed by nature, wrong, I humbly confess it all in the presence of the protectors, with folded hands, prostrating myself again and again, my mind terrified by the misery to come. I beseech all the gods of the world to please accept my evils and wrongs. Since these are not good, in future I shall do them no more. Gladly do I rejoice in the virtue that relieves the misery of all those in unfortunate states and that places those with suffering in happiness. I rejoice in that gathering of virtue that is the cause for the Arhat's awakening. I rejoice in the definite freedom of embodied creatures from the miseries of cyclic existence. I rejoice in the awakening of the Buddhas and also in the spiritual levels of their sons. And with gladness I rejoice in the ocean of virtue from developing an awakening mind that wishes all beings to be happy, as well as in the deeds that bring them benefit. With folded hands I beseech the Buddhas of all directions to shine the lamp of Dharma for all bewildered in misery's gloom. With folded hands I beseech the conquerors who wish to pass away to please remain for countless eons and not to leave the world in darkness. Thus by the virtue collected through all that I have done, may the pain of every living creature be completely cleared away. May I be the doctor and the medicine, and may I be the nurse for all sick beings in the world until everyone is healed. May a rain of food and drink descend to clear away the pain of thirst and hunger, and during the eon of famine, may I myself change into food and drink. May I become an inexhaustible treasure for those who are poor and destitute. May I turn into all things they could need, and may this be placed close beside them. Without any sense of loss, I shall give up my body and enjoyments, as well as all my virtues of the three times, for the sake of benefiting all. By giving up all sorrow is transcended, and my mind will realize the sorrowless state. It is the best that I now give everything to all beings in the same way as I shall at death. Having given this body up for the pleasure of all living beings, by killing, abusing and beating it, may they always do as they please. Although they may play with my body and make it a source of jest and blame, because I have given it up to them, what is the use of holding it dear? Therefore I shall let them to do anything to it that does not cause them any harm. And when anyone encounters me, may I never be meaningless for him. If in those who encounter me a faithful or an angry thought arises, may that eternally become the source for fulfilling all their wishes. May all who say bad things to me or cause me any other harm, and those who mock and insult me, have the fortune to fully awaken. May I be protector for those without one, a guide for all travelers on the way. May I be a bridge, a boat and a ship for all who wish to cross the water. May I be an island for those who seek one, and a lamp for those desiring light. May I be a bed for all who wish to rest, and a sleep for all who want to sleep. May I be a wishing jewel, a magic vase, powerful mantras and great medicine. May I become a wish-fulfilling tree and a cow of plenty for the world. Just like space and the great elements such as earth, may I always support the life of all the boundless creatures. and until they pass away from pain, may also be the source of life for all the realms of varied beings. They reach into the ends of space, just as the previous that. So this completes the practice of purifying negative deeds and accumulating virtue. And so next we'll be developing aspirational bodhicitta with commitment. And this will be done by first taking refuge to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and then develop with regard to taking refuge, even though it has been done through the practice of the seven limb. But I think, as is said by Panchen Lobsang Chujin, there is a word which reads Lama, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, please pay attention to me. So from the depth of your heart you develop strong trust and faith to the Lama, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who are your Lamas. And just as the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have generated such a bodhicitta in the past and practiced the bodhisattva way of life, and just as they have actually led the ways of life of a bodhisattva after having generated the mind, after having received the bodhisattva vow, similarly I will also, for the benefit of all suffering mother sentient beings, I will cultivate this altruistic mind or bodhicitta. And having developed this aspirational bodhicitta, I will develop an intense wish to lead the ways of life of bodhisattva and thereby receive the bodhisattva vow and practice the bodhisattva way of life accordingly. So repeat this. So if you have no problem in the leg, then sit in a kneeling position. You can either place, you can sit in a kneeling position, either placing the right knee on the ground. And if you are someone, if you don't want to receive the bodhisattva vow, then you can just develop a good mind. But it is really good if you are able to develop it, because if you give up right from the beginning saying I can't do, then a time will never come when you will do. So therefore encourage yourself and develop this mind, and determine that you will never give up this mind. And having generated this mind, I will lead the ways of life of bodhisattva. So in this way you develop the aspirational bodhicitta as well as engaging bodhicitta at the same time. So imagine the actual presence of Buddha in front of you. As I said earlier, we always pray and appreciate the qualities of the Buddha and see him as the ultimate object of refuge, and recall likewise the presence of great masters and practitioners from India, from Tibet and so on, and consider me as a kind of messenger. And so when we when we say these lines, you should repeat them. And in short, you should think that I will develop this aspirational bodhicitta and then receive the bodhisattva vow, as has been done by the Buddhas and bodhisattvas that I have imagined in front of me. And in the case of the Buddhas and bodhisattvas who are your objects of refuge, their heart practice or main practice is development of such a bodhicitta, and therefore I will stage by stage practice them. And this is a good statement. Right now, even if you do not have the capacity to actually practice, but you make a commitment to undertake such a practice, and then from today onwards, by following the footsteps of these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that you visualized in front, I will also become one similar to them, and fulfill the purposes of sentient beings until to the end of the space. So develop such an aspiration, spirit, and repeat this. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, please pay attention to me, just as Buddhas generated bodhicitta in the past and practiced the Bodhisattva precepts stage by stage. Similarly, in my case, to benefit other sentient beings, I will develop bodhicitta and practice the Bodhisattva precepts stage by stage. And when you repeat this for the second time, imagine or develop one-pointed faith towards the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas imagined in front, and also visualize the presence of sentient beings who are like yourself, wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, but still deprived of happiness and full of suffering. And even in terms of your own personal purpose, if you neglect the well-being of others, there's nothing that you will benefit from them. And this can be clearly understood if you study your present plight. On the other hand, if you follow the good examples of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, develop the aspirational bodhicitta, and in actual practice, if you try to help them as much as possible, that really will be the source of long-term benefit and happiness for yourself. And therefore, from the depth of your heart, you should make such a mind and make a clear determination and repeat this for the second time. Dala guma jedus chitrang gun jedus chaju tu ne cheba chaju sembe la ba cheda dem she ne ba da jang do la phen do chaju sem ne che ji chaju sembe la ba rimba shin do la ba ra ji When you do the final or the third repetition, then again you draw the attention of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and repeat, and then you repeat it. And when you repeat the line which says, I will develop this aspirational bodhicitta, then you are receiving the developing the aspirational bodhicitta. And when you come across the line which says, I will generate the develop the Bodhisattva precept stage by stage, then imagine that you have received the Bodhisattva vow. And if you have already developed Bodhisattva vow earlier and has not degenerated, then imagine this is further enhanced and strengthened. And if some breakage, violation, and degeneration has taken place, then imagine the degenerations have been restored. Dala Gumba Zedus Chitrangun Jidishi Chaju Tune Jeva Chaju Sembe Laba Dada Rimshin Neva Dajan Dola Pender Chaju Semne Chijish Tishin Tune Laba Rimbashin Dola Bara This completes developing actual Bodhisattva vow. And this is followed by lines which says that today I have made my life meaningful, and my life is fruitful, and I've obtained this precious human life. I am now born in the lineage of the Buddha. I am the child of Buddha now. And therefore, whatever may come, I will perform the work in accordance with this lineage and never defile this faultless lineage. So you are upraising the spirit of your mind or strengthening enthusiasm or appreciation. So this process of receiving aspirational bodhicitta and bodhisattva vow at the same time, I have received this from my senior tutor Ling Rinpoche, and also when I received the transmission of the Lungam teaching Vado Manjushri, as is found in their text. I received it, and then after coming into India, when I was for the first time giving the translation of the small length stages of meditation, I have again received this practice of developing aspirational bodhicitta and bodhisattva bow at the same time from Ling Rinpoche. So now we'll continue with the text from the mind training. Second point here discusses the special practice of transforming the misfortune into the path through purifying negative deeds and accumulating virtues. And this has four parts. The first part is accumulating merit. And if you do not want suffering and want happiness, then in relation to sentient beings or in relation to higher objects like Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, irrespective of whether the material gift is big, small or middle, but with pure motivation, we should share those material possessions and give them and offer them, and then dedicate to achieve unsurpassing enlightenment. And second is purifying the negative deeds. From beginningless time until now, motivated by afflictive emotions, and we end up defiling our mind with natural negative deeds and prohibited negative deeds. And this must be confessed and purified through the practice of the four antidotal powers. And next is making offerings to the evil spirits. And first of all, it is not good to see all your sufferings as something created by an external agent like an evil spirit. But through repeated investigation and analysis, if you feel that this is really due to the harm of an evil spirit and so on, then you should reflect on the fact how even these evil spirits who are harming you today must have been so kind in many of the past lives, as we have discussed earlier. And then especially develop loving kindness and compassion towards these beings, and meditate on patience. The fourth is making dharma offerings to the dharma protectors and seeking their help. And there you should make clean offerings, and in terms of motivation it should be extremely good. And that means you should mentally also think this offering is something extremely good, vast, and then invite the Dharma protectors, make supplication and make the offering to them in accordance with the ritual text. And next, second point discusses about how to integrate all this as a practice that you can do within a lifetime. And the root text says one must train in the five powers. The first power is called power of motivation. In this case, you should think that from today until I achieve enlightenment, and particularly until I die, and particularly at least in this year or in this month, and particularly in this very day, I will ensure that I will not give opportunity to root and the secondary afflictive emotions that are induced by self-grasping. And I will not allow my body, mind to be enslaved even for a moment by these afflictive emotions. So thus you should develop a strong motivation. And the second is the power of virtuous seed. That is to develop the bodhicitta which you have not developed, and to ensure the continuous abidance of such a bodhicitta that you have developed and to further enhance and strengthen it. The third is the power of eradicating the negative deeds, and as has been discussed during the practice of exchanging oneself for others, by seeing the faults of self-cherishing attitude and the self-grasping and the disadvantages of ignoring the well-being of other sentient beings, and likewise the faults of afflictive emotions, you must eradicate them and make effort to eliminate them, as you said in the Bodhicharya Avatara. It's fine if I am burnt alive or killed or beheaded, but I will never submit myself to the enemy of afflictive emotions. The fourth is the power of prayer, which means that you should in general dedicate all virtuous deeds that you have accumulated within the world, within the samsara and beyond the samsara, and particularly all those virtuous deeds that you have committed in relation to your body, speech and mind, and then dedicate and offer this power by thinking that through the power of this merit, may this benefit all sentient beings, and particularly that I'll be able to develop bodhicitta within my mind. And the fifth power is called the power of habituation. This has been discussed several times earlier. That means in all times and all situations, you should meditate only on such virtuous practices like bodhicitta. Without separating yourself from the favorable factors, if you continue your practice and make your mind habituated with such a practice, then you will be able to perfect it, as Shantideva said, that there is nothing that will become easier when habituated. And likewise, the great master Chagavachambo says that this mind with the fault has one great quality. That means if you give a training, the mind can get trained in it. And the practice of these five powers should also be related as an instruction that you can use at the time of the death. First is the power of virtuous seed, that is purifying negative deeds through the four antidotal powers, so that you have nothing to regret and fear at the time of the death. And particularly you should remove all types of self-cherishing attitude towards your body, because the root of all afflictive emotion is this grasping of the self, and it is because of this self-grasping that in whichever of the six migrations you are born, you get attached to this body, and it is in the pursuit of serving this body and for the sake of getting food, clothing and so on, you end up committing many negative deeds like the 10 non-virtuous deeds and so on. So you should make a determination thinking that I will ensure that in the future lives I will not take a body, such a bad body which is produced by actions and afflictive emotions, and in this way let your mind abide in the nature of Dharmakaya. So such intense motivation should be developed. The second is power of motivation. This is similar as we discussed earlier. The third is power of repudiation, that is remember the objects that make emotions and make commitments and yourself by such afflictive emotions. Therefore, the power of prayer, that is to pray that may I never be separated from bodhicitta in all situations, and may I never be overpowered by afflictive emotions like self-grasping. The power of habituation, that means at the time of the death, you should observe certain physical conduct, that is try to have your head towards north, and then sleep on the right side of your head, and let the right cheek of your face placed on the right hand, and then the ring finger of the right hand should be put or block the breath that comes from the right nostril, and let the left hand be placed on the left thigh, and then in relation to the incoming and outgoing of the breath through the left nostril, we should undertake the practice of giving and receiving, and then die or then pass away. And the third is the measure of having trained your mind. The measure of having trained your mind is if you're able to see in order to understand the measure of having trained your mind, it is first of all important to realize that all these hundreds of words of the Buddha and their commentaries, they are all taught for disciplining and taming the self-grasping. So therefore see whether your body, speech and mind, the conduct of your body, speech and mind is nourishing and sustaining such a self-grasping, or whether your conduct of body, speech and mind is discouraging and reducing the strength of the self-grasping. And if you find that your ways of life are contributing towards the strengthening of the self-grasping, then this clearly shows that the purpose of your hearing, thinking and meditation is now wrong. And if you find your conduct of body, speech and mind reducing and weakening the self-grasping, then this is a clear sign that your Dharma practice is hitting the target and it is on the right track, and that is a genuine indication that you are able to develop the practice of mind training. And so here it says, the text says, that out of the two witnesses, one should take into consideration the main witness. There are several types of witnesses, whether you are undertaking a genuine practice or not. One witness is that people will start saying that his mind or her mind has become more gentler and so on. That is also one witness, but this is not enough. What is really important is that in all situations, when you examine your own mind, you should find that you are not deceiving yourself. So that you do not have to feel repentant and regret. And therefore, as an indication that you have trained successfully in the mind training, is that if you have continuous peace of mind. The actual measure of having trained the mind is that right from the practice, right from the beginning practice of the preliminary practice until to the training of the ultimate bodhicitta, when you are able to develop each and every realizations in relation to the given topics, then this is indication that you have trend in the mind training. That means whatever obstructive factors arise, if these factors do not become a cause to waste your life. And also another indication of having trained the mind is that if you possess the five great features, then this is indication that you have trained the mind. And if you are able to see the development of bodhicitta as the essence of all the scriptures, and if you undertake this practice for all times to come, then you are a kind of a great bodhisattva. and similarly having conviction in the cause effect relationship, and then thirdly, the afflictive emotions are not able to control you, and in terms of your body and mental behavior, if they are not departed from the 10 Mahayana conducts, and another indication is that if you are able to undertake such a practice even at a time when there is destruction, then this is another indication, a sign. This is like a horseman who is thoroughly trained in horse riding, then even on those occasions when he is distracted, if the horse bolts, still he will not fall from the horse. So similarly, even if others make fun of you and so on, if you do not get angry and rather pray that all these negative deeds towards you become a core stage of enlightenment, then this is another sign. And then the fourth point explains some of the pledges that one must practice as a person who is training in the mind training. That means your mind training should not contradict your commitment. This means that sometimes we say that I am a person who undertakes mind training, so such and such will not harm me, and therefore you will ignore some of the minor precepts. And sometimes you say that if mind training is there, you don't need anything, and thus you will lead a way of life which contradicts the general practice of the general teaching of the Buddha, and that is also wrong. And sometimes in the name of mind training you destroy the environment, like destroying those special disturbing places, cutting harmful trees digging harmful grounds, or defiling harmful waters and so on, and also visiting places where there are epidemic diseases and so on. This is again wrong. Then your mind training also should not become partial. It should be done in relation to all sentient beings. And then also you should not forcibly act in relation to sentient beings unless it is absolutely necessary, because if you do so, then they will become angry, and then that will become a cause for harm for many lives to come. And even in terms of your relation to other human beings, even in the case of a person to whom you had helped with great kindness, even in relation to those people, if you act angrily or aggressively, then they will forget all your kindness, and that will become a cause for anger and so on. And in general, we should be able to see that all the faults within the samsara are originated from action and afflictive emotions, and they are accumulated by actions and afflictive emotions, and particularly it is the self-grasping which is mainly responsible. So therefore, in the case of a person who is undertaking mind training practice, if you have the capacity to deal with something forcibly, then you should do so while combating with these afflictive emotions. And and then there are certain practices that you should specially be doing. The first is you should be very careful in relation to certain specific peoples, like the three objects of refuge, abbots, preceptors, and lamas with whom you have dharmic connection, and your parents who are kind to you. Because in relation to these objects, even if you commit some minor negative deed, the negative result will be very heavy. And secondly, you should be careful with those people like your family members with whom you associate all the time, because there is likelihood of developing more afflictive emotions in relation to them. And you should also be thirdly careful in relation to those lay peoples or ordained sanghas with whom you have equal kind of qualification and so on, because then there is possibility of developing jealousy, competitiveness and so on. And the fourth is you should particularly be careful with regard to those people with whom you may have done nothing, but they may have very wrong ideas about you. Because in relation to these people, if you get angry, then you will have no opportunity to develop kindness or compassion. And then fifthly, you should also be careful in relation to those people with whom you have done nothing, or they have done nothing to you, but merely by hearing their name you start disliking them, and there is likelihood of developing anger and hatred towards these people. And the next mind training practice is that when you enter into hearing, thinking and meditation, you should undertake such practices wholeheartedly, irrespective of whether the facilitating factors are there or not. And next is when you engage in the mind training, one commitment and precept is that you should change your attitude but behave as you used to behave before. And therefore the great master Chekha Vasimbo has said that when you undertake the mind training practice, you should do it quietly and without making a display of it to others. And then it says that having entered into this mind training practice, do not highlight or do not speak about the faults of others. And because of wrong motivation, we end up highlighting the faults of human beings and non-human beings, so that is wrong. And also you should not say that I am a person who is undertaking mind training, therefore I cannot go with this person or associate with this person, because that way again you are segregating that person. As a result of maintaining practice, you should not have any clinging towards yourself. And then another commitment is give up all hopes of fruits. That means you should not expect, as a result of maintaining, you should not expect any achievement in the forms of perfections of samsara, and also in terms of achievement of liberation and enlightenment, you should not aspire them for your personal well-being and happiness, but for the sake of all sentient beings. And so sometimes when you read this kind of texts, you are not so sure which words go together which other words. So there are many stories of people made a mistake. So for example, there is this case story of an inscription on a stupa where it says Sarsongkhapa Losang Thapala Namo. That means I pay homage to Tsongkhapa, the Easterner. So there was someone who visited this and he wanted so he wanted to make a show of himself to others how good a reader he is, and he started reading that inscription and he instead of saying Sarsongkhapa Losang Thapala Namo, he said Sarsongkhapa No Zangthapala Namo. So it just it makes no sense. So which is really like saying the Easterner Tsongkhapa is a mind and I pay homage to Zangthapa who is nobody. So I was reading like that. And then there is also story of someone reading Karika. So Karika is a Sanskrit word which means words. And then someone read it and he not knowing how to read this, he said Ka, and then he said Rika. Instead of saying Karika, he said Ka and Rika, which again makes no sense. And next, when it comes to undertaking such a mind, next commitment is avoid poisonous food. That means, in general, with good food, it nourishes our body. But if it gets mixed with poison, becomes a cause for your death. So therefore, in general, hearing, thinking, we achieve enlightenment. But if they are mixed with the eight worldly concerns, and then this will get mixed with grasping to self and mind, and destroy the life of liberation and enlightenment. And then the next precept or commitment is, and if someone does slight wrong with you, if you always keep it in your mind and then revenge it, then that is wrong and this should not be done. And then the next commitment is do not say those words which would hurt the mind of others. And the next commitment is do not ambush. That means we have a tendency to wait and lie in ambush. That means we have a tendency of remembering the wrongdoings of some other people, and as and when there is an opportunity, we tend to highlight that wrongdoing by other people and then try to victimize that person that is wrong. And then next precept is do not strike at the vital point. That means do not pick up those faults of others which will be very destructive in the mind of others. And the next is do not put the load of zoo on a ox. So if there is a common task to the attendant, then you should not let it to be done by others if that person has no capacity to complete it. And the next is do not rush for the reward. That means we have the tendency, if there is likelihood of getting praise, then we would be the first to run and say it was done by me. So that is also wrong. Let others get the benefit of it. And then do not do not turn gods into devil. That means even though you have entered into Dharma practice and whatever thinking, meditation and contemplation you do, if this becomes a source for nourishing the strength of self-grasping attitude, then this is really like the gods becoming devil. And next precept is, for the sake of happiness, do not invite suffering. That means in order to achieve your personal happiness, do not bring sufferings on others. The fifth point is showing the precepts of the mind training again. All yoga should be done by one. And that means in all your ways of life you should undertake such a yoga of mind training. And then it speaks about two activities to be done in the beginning and in the end. And that means right from the morning you develop a correct motivation, and develop a motivation to eliminate negative deeds and cultivate positive practices. And the next precept is, train in those that are easier to practice. This is important because the yellow Tibetan text that was distributed earlier contains a versified explanation of this root text of the mind training. Even though I don't have the oral translation, I asked to publish it and distribute it because it is very easy to read and quite easy to understand. And the next precept is that whether you encounter physical suffering or mental unhappiness, try to transform into the path and dedicate it to achieving enlightenment. And the next precept is that ensure to preserve the precepts, the three precepts or vows that you have accepted. And the next precept is train in the three difficult practices. That means first of all it is very difficult for us to remember the antidote to afflicted emotion, and secondly it is difficult to stop, thirdly it is difficult to stop their continuity. Therefore you should identify the afflicted emotions, recall the faults, and through many ways try to eliminate them. And next precept is change everything into the Mahayana path. That means all your ways of life should be motivated by loving kindness, compassion towards all sentient beings, and then develop the aspirational bodhicitta, and until to the end of the samsara dedicate all your activities, physical, verbal and mental, and whatever you see, hear, touch, transform all those into the Mahayana path. And next practice is value and encompassing and far-reaching practice. That means when you train your mind in the bodhicitta, the object, that it should not be biased in terms of the object, in terms of the sentient beings. It should be targeted towards all sentient beings. So it should not be just, it should not be just by the word of the mouth, but from the depth of your heart. And that is why the great master Chekhova, at the time of his death, he called his student Sechowa and he said, things are not running in accordance with my wish, please make an offering to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And then he asked, what is it that did not fulfill, that did not come as you wished? And then he said, I desired that I am able to take all the sufferings of sentient beings on my heart, but I get this vision of being born in a pure land. Next practice is to train in the three principal courses. That means in general, whatever hearing, thinking and meditation you do, and particularly after having entered into this teaching of the mind training, you have the facilitating factor, the facilitating internal factors of having found this precious human life with leisure and endowment, and you also have faith, devotion and wisdom, and as an external condition you also have good spiritual masters, and therefore if you are able to lead a meaningful life which is not falling into one of the extremes in terms of your livelihood and so on, then we will be able to achieve a result as has been achieved by Domtomba after meeting Choboje. But we are unable to properly develop such qualities. This clearly shows that something is missing. So therefore you should think that I will develop all the necessary factors and qualities as causal factors. And next precept is you should first train in the growth practices. That means you should thoroughly analyze your mind, and whichever afflictive emotions are more aggressive and more violent, try to develop antidote to this. And next precept is adopt that which is most important. That means to you should observe pure moral ethics, which is extremely important as a basis for development of bodhicitta. And then the third precept is to meditate on the three aspects without degeneration. That means you should not lose your devotion to the Lama, and do not lose your introspection and care, and do not lose your enthusiasm in the mind-training practice. Because if you have no devotion to the Lama, then no qualities will grow. And if you have no care and introspection degenerates, then there is no way to maintain a pure ethical discipline. And if you lack enthusiasm and interest to the mind training, then you will not be able to develop faith towards the qualities of bodhicitta, and similarly the aspiration that is induced by it, and then all your practice will become a lip service and not genuine. And next practice is that you should ensure that you are not separated from the three. That means offering service to the objects of refuge, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and your, that means in terms of your body, it should not be separated from Lama, and it should not be separated, it should not be without service, without making service to the Lama and the three objects of refuge, and your body also should not be without making prostrations, circumambulations and so on. So your body should be performing all those virtuous practices, and verbally you should take refuge, and should not be separated from the recitation and meditation of personal deities and so on. And mentally you should not be without the meditation on bodhicitta. And in the case of then the next precept is that in the case of some people, when they undertake such mind-training meditation and practice, they get such impressions they would say that because I have undertaken maintaining, I find more and more people saying negative things to me, and my self-grasping and afflictive emotions have become stronger, and I have lost my wealth, and I see more harms through evil spirits and so on, and therefore they will relapse. They will not develop interest in maintaining. So there is such a risk. And the next is and at this time when you have all the external and internal factors, therefore I will fulfill my purposes, not only this life, not of this life, but for many lives to come, and that also through practice and study. Next precept says, do not misunderstand. That means when you see some people suffering from all types of sufferings, then you should meditate on compassion. And not develop compassion towards these people who are suffering from all types of sufferings, and not towards those who are doing some who are undertaking some hardships of hearing, thinking and meditation. So that is called wrong compassion. And there is a story of some people after seeing the weak frail body of Milarepa, made the comment, said how compassionate this fellow is. So that is wrong compassion. And the next is called wrong aspiration. Instead of aspiring to achieve enlightenment, if you aspire for the sense of the worldly achievements, that's wrong aspiration. And then next is wrong endeavor. And you should make an endeavor to deliver all sentient beings to the state of enlightenment. Instead of doing that, if you end up making endeavor towards enjoying the offerings that is being made to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha and to the ordained Sanghas, then that is wrong endeavor. Next is a wrong rejoice. We should develop rejoicement towards the virtuous deeds performed by Buddhas, Bodhisattvas and so on. But instead of doing this, you develop rejoicement to those who you do not like, and when they encounter some suffering, then you develop kind of rejoice. So that is wrong rejoicement. And then next is wrong patience. And when you engage in hearing, thinking and meditation and develop patience and undertake hardship, by seeing these people you develop some kind of so there you are unable to develop patience, but you have great forbearance and patience in terms of worldly activities of destroying the enemies and looking after the friends, relatives and so on. And next is wrong testing, wrong experience. Those of us who have entered into the Mahayana path, we should test the Dharma through hearing, thinking and meditation, But instead of that, we end up testing the sensual enjoyments out of attachment, hatred and so on. That is wrong. Next precept is do not alternate. That means when you undertake mind training, it should be one pointed, and we should not alternate. And what we normally do is sometimes we perform certain virtuous practices. Certain virtuous practices by body and mind or speech, but not all the time. And the next precept says that you should practice unflinchingly. That means without hesitation and doubt you should undertake the practice. And the next precept is that you should analyze and investigate, and you should analyze and investigate your motivation, your action, and it is in this way you should pass your practice in life. And next, after having done some good things, you should not be boastful and do not make a display of it. And the next precept is you should not be angry when there is slight changes of respect or changes of offering and so on. And next precept is don't make a short-lived attempt. And then also do not expect for praises and gratitude having done something to others. So this completes the training on conventional bodhicitta. Now we'll read from the Bodhicaryavatara, wisdom chapter. So right from the topic that speaks about how to appreciate the human life that we have formed, right from that, when we proceed stage by stage and cultivate understanding and experience in relation to different topics, then you are able to gain a complete picture and understanding of the whole stages of the path. And then based on that understanding, if you make your mind habituated with these different cycles and topics or practices, and particularly when you undertake a genuine experience through meditation and doing the two levels of practice in the form of meditation and in the form of post-meditative session practice, and then gradually you will be able to develop some confidence, thinking that if I make further effort, I will be able to develop these experiences. So with that kind of confidence, thinking that you will be able to develop these realizations if you continue your practice, and then if you continue your meditation and practice through a combined practice of one-pointed meditation and analytical meditation, then a time will come when you think in this way, your mind gets very strongly moved, and if you do not think for a long time, if such experiences doesn't come, then that is called contrived experience. You develop contrived experience, and if you continue this with this practice, then gradually a time will come when with the slightest encountering of a factor like as and when you reflect on a topic like impermanence, you will be able to develop strong understanding within your mind, strong feeling within your mind. So that is called uncontrived experience or effortless experience. So that is the kind of experience that we need. So therefore, having turned one's mind through such a stage by stage, we develop wholehearted faith to bodhicitta, which cherishes the well-being of other sentient beings more than oneself. And in this regard, when you are able to develop effortless experience, then you develop bodhicitta and you become a bodhisattva, a person with the bodhicitta mind. And the Tsongkhapa explains the measure of having developed the mind of renunciation, and he says, and he explains this in his three principal aspects of the path by saying that in this way, day and night, when you cultivate this aspiration towards liberation, and as a result of this, day and night, if you develop this aspiration to achieve enlightenment automatically, then you have developed renunciation, and that is the measure of having developed a correct renunciation. So similarly, in the case of bodhicitta also, having trained continuously, then gradually, if you are able to develop such an experience with the slightest, with the encountering of the slightest factor, like for example, if you recite a line by saying that all these helpless sentient beings are my mother, as soon as you reflect on a line like this one, then immediately if you develop strong feeling and concern towards them, then that is a measure of having developed bodhicitta, and then you become a bodhisattva. So this bodhicitta is really like a machine, or like something that changes the direction of the course of the boat in which you are sailing. Now it is not enough to change the course of direction of the boat, but what you really have to do is to make the boat move. And that means, in order to have a pure practice of helping other sentient beings, you should first of all purify your own mind. And the best way of purifying one's mind is development of loving kindness, compassion, bodhicitta. These are, as I explained earlier, are the most important methods to purify your mind. And positive practices will help reduce and suppress the afflictive emotions. But in terms of total elimination of these afflictive emotions, it is only the wisdom mind or wisdom that realizes emptiness. And as I said earlier, this is so because in the case of many of these afflictive emotions, they are a kind of corrupted wisdom, so they are a kind of a philosophical viewpoint. So even if they are wrong, they also employ one or the other kind of reasons. So therefore, the only way to remove this kind of afflictive emotions, it is important to develop the view of emptiness. And that is why the ultimate cause of samsara, or ultimate root of the samsara, is the ignorance, about which there are many viewpoints. According to some, they say that the main cause or root of the samsara in the form of ignorance is the grasping of the phenomena and not the grasping of the person. And whereas in accordance with the Prasangika Madhyamika, there is no subtlety in terms of the grasping of the person and the grasping of the phenomena. And Aryadeva explains this in his Ratanavali or Precious Garland by saying that so long as there is grasping of the psychophysical aggregate, till that long there will be the grasping of the I and the person. And when there is this grasping of the I and the person, again you will accumulate action, and in this way you will get entrapped within the cycle of existence. And likewise, there are other quotations where he says that a person is not the earth, nor the water, nor the fire, nor the wind, nor the space, and not all of them, and apart from them, where is the I? And therefore, in relation to them, there is a grasping of the person, and therefore he says that so long as there is this grasping of the psychophysical aggregate, there will be the grasping of the I, and whenever there is the grasping of the I, then again you will accumulate karma, and from there arises the cycle of existence, the samsara. And therefore here when we talk about two types of grasping, the grasping of the person, the grasping of the phenomena, grasping of the person refers to the misconception which perceives the person and the I as having independent or inherent existence, and the grasping of the phenomena refers to the perception of all other phenomena other than the I and the person, and seeing them as having independent or inherent existence. And therefore, in order to get liberated from samsara, from the cycle of existence, we must get rid of grasping of the phenomena and grasping of the person. And therefore, grasping of the phenomena and the person is an obscuration to liberation. Therefore, the root cause of cycle of existence is self-grasping, the grasping of the person, that which sees the person as having independent inherent existence, and that is the root cause of all afflictive emotions. Similarly, Aryadeva in his 400 verses also says that just as the sense, the physical sense powers abide or exist on the physical body, just as in the case of the physical sense power, it pervades to all other sense powers. For example, the physical sense power pervades on eye sense power, ear sense power, and so on. But the eye sense power does not pervade to ear sense power or to the rest of the body. So similarly, attachment and hatred does not pervade on ignorance, but ignorance pervades on all other afflictive emotions. And therefore, by destroying this ignorance which pervades to all afflictive emotions, you will be able to put an end to all types of afflictive emotions. And many of these afflictive emotions arise having ignorance as the cause, and many of these afflictive emotions accompany ignorance, and it is this way ignorance perverts to all these afflictive emotions. And normally when we perceive ourselves, for example when we think about my body or my mind, you get the notion that I am the one who is the controller of the mind and the body, and you tend to see the eye, tend to see the body and the mind as something that's being enjoyed and controlled by the eye, and therefore you see the relation between the body, the mind, and the person as like the relation between a servant and a master. However, if we ask a question by saying whose body, whose mind, then you will answer by saying that this is my body and my mind. So therefore, I is a kind of basis of designation, and then we have the mind and the body as is owned and possessed by them, and therefore we get the, when we think about the I, we get the notion as if it is something that is existing separately, independently, and inherently apart from the body and the mind. So therefore we get this kind of impression as if the body and the mind are totally unrelated to the I, and it is in this way we tend to develop this grasping of the self, where we tend to see this I and the person as substantially separate and independent, and sometimes according to our perception and according to through certain analysis, even if we come to the conclusion that there is no I that exists or that is found through the seven modes of analysis, but still we might, our understanding of emptiness of self is the emptiness of substantially self-supporting person, and so it is possible that our understanding of emptiness may be only the emptiness of substantially and self-existence of substantial self-supporting person. And therefore, in this connection, Nagarjuna says that just as you are able to understand such an emptiness on the person, if you are able to understand that on the body and so on, and then this clearly shows that you have understood the meaning of emptiness. And when the different philosophical schools make a presentation of the designated phenomena and the substantially existent phenomena, then they would identify the person as just designated and the person as substantially existent. So therefore, even though we may be using the same reason of analyzing the existence of such a self through the seven mode of analysis, but when it comes to actual understanding, we might end up developing only the understanding of the view of emptiness of the person as is explained in the lower Buddhist schools of thought, and not in accordance with what is explained in the higher Buddhist schools of thought like the Madhyamika, and particularly the Parisankhika Madhyamika system of thought. And therefore, in order to eliminate all types of afflictive emotions, you must get rid of ignorance. And ignorance can be eliminated, or self-grasping can be eliminated, by developing a mind whose mode of apprehension of the object is totally contradictory to that self-grasping. And therefore, the wisdom understanding emptiness is the mind which directly opposes the ignorance. And in the case of meaning of understanding of emptiness, Aryadeva in his 400 verses clearly says that ignorance can be eliminated by meditating on selflessness. And in fact, this is a kind of slogan which is made by all the Buddhist schools of thought, and therefore emptiness is taught by mindfulness school of thought and also Savatantika Madhyamika school thought, and probably the word emptiness may be used by some non-Buddhist schools of thought as well. And for example, in the Vaibhashika, when they talk about the four seals, they talk about emptiness and selflessness. And therefore here therefore in order to develop a unique understanding of meaning of emptiness, you should understand the meaning of interdependent relation. So therefore Aryadeva in his 400 verses says that when you are able to understand the interconnected reality, then you will be able to see emptiness, and through that way you will be able to get rid of ignorance. So here we are not talking about the emptiness as is explained by all Buddhist schools of thought, and it is not the emptiness of lack of substantially independent and self-supporting person as is explained by the Vaibhashikas and Sotantikas. And the emptiness is also not as is explained by mindfulness thought, which is. So here we are talking about emptiness as is explained by the Parasangika Madhyamika school of thought. So emptiness here means that from the side of the object will not find any traces of independently existent nature of that object. This does not mean to say that things do not exist at all. They conventionally exist, nominally exist, and that is very true. But however, when we search in that direction, in that object, we are unable to find it. That leaves us the only alternative, that the existence is only nominal and conventional. And even when we use the word nominal, it does not mean to say that there is only name and no object. But this rather means that apart from what has been designated, nothing can be found out. And therefore, having no inherent existence, having no objective existence, having no independent existence, these are of same meaning from the Prasangika Madhyamika viewpoint view. And such an understanding that things do not exist from their side by themselves or independently, this can be understood by understanding the subtle meaning of interdependent reality, interdependent connection. And if you are able to develop such an understanding, then you will be able to remove the two extremes at the same time. And that's why Aryadeva has said that if you see the dependently arisen nature, you will be able to get rid of ignorance. And the same thing is said in Madhyamika Avatara by Chandrakirti, and also in the Fundamental Wisdom by Nagarjuna, where he says that things are designated and if interdependent, therefore there is no phenomena whose nature is not empty. And of course, by merely seeing the interdependent origination, you can't get rid of ignorance. And what we need is to make our mind totally and repeatedly habituated with such an understanding. And through that way, when you strengthen the power and the capacity of that mind, then you will gain a clear insight into the meaning of emptiness. And when you achieve the perfect state of clear insight into emptiness, and particularly gradually when you are able to discern emptiness without any medium, without any generic image, then you are able to see emptiness directly. In order to achieve that state, you need to remove the self-grasping, which is based on imaginary conceptions. And therefore, that which leads the path influenced by bodhicitta, and that which directly confronts the afflictive emotions, particularly ignorance, is the view of emptiness alone. And therefore, in order to remove the defilements of afflictive emotions and to remove the defilements of obscuration to omniscience, it is the wisdom understanding emptiness which is the direct antidote. And of course it should have this view of emptiness. In order to become our core stage of enlightenment, it must be supported and must have the backing of the development of bodhicitta and the practice of the six perfections. And it is for that purpose, it is because of this, in the verse number 1 of this wisdom chapter, it says, thereby all these branch practices the Buddha taught for the sake of wisdom. And therefore all these teachings that the Buddha has given are for the purpose of leading sentient beings to achieve enlightenment. In other words, in order to achieve the level where one has eliminated obscuration to enlightenment, the Buddhas taught all these multifarious teachings. In order to remove such obscuration to enlightenment, the only path is to meditate on all-encompassing emptiness. And it is this understanding of emptiness that first of all you remove the wrong conceptions, like the four wrong conceptions, like seeing what is impure as a pure, what is impermanent as permanent, what is suffering as happiness, and what lacks self as having self. And through that way you develop a wisdom understanding emptiness, suffering and so on. So these texts are, these are the teachings that will gradually lead you to emptiness. And then secondly, when you discuss about other points like that there's no self which is permanent, independent, or there's no self which is self-supporting, so this shows the grosser meaning of selflessness, and this will give some jolt to the view that grasps the self, and so therefore such teachings will make you descend on the view of emptiness, or meaning that these teachings will directly lead to the understanding of subtle emptiness, and then finally you will alight on the meaning of suchness or emptiness. That means when the subtle meaning of emptiness is taught, then these teachings lead directly to emptiness. Therefore all these teachings of Buddhas are meant for achieving supreme enlightenment, and to achieve supreme enlightenment you need to remove the obscuration to enlightenment, and to do that you need to develop this wisdom having all the supreme aspects. So here you can see a gradual process of how sentient beings are led to the understanding of emptiness. And therefore in this verse number 1 also says that all these branches, that means the first five perfections, which shows the method side of the practice of the Bodhisattvas, all this the Buddha taught for the sake of the wisdom. That means for the development of wisdom realizing emptiness. Therefore, those who want to purify or eliminate these sufferings cultivate the wisdom. So therefore, in other words, this is saying that the vast aspects of methods that has been taught by Buddha are for development of wisdom. So this is a kind of general statement, and if you ask a more specific question by saying what is that wisdom, then it's wisdom understanding emptiness. And then if you ask what is that emptiness, then that means, this is answered by saying that emptiness means things do not exist as we see today, as we observe today. Now if you again ask how this is so, then this is answered by saying that all phenomena should be categorized into two levels of truth, conventional truth and ultimate truth. Conventional truth refers to the temporary mode of existence of phenomena, and then there is an ultimate mode of existence of phenomena, and in between these two there is a big disparity between the appearance and the reality. And in fact in our day-to-day lives activities we encounter the gap between appearance and reality. For example, if you meet a person and he speaks very softly and very nicely and so on, you get so impressed with that person, then you will start believing to that person and start sharing many of your stories and sharing many informations. Then later on, that person who was so attractive at a superficial glance, he would act almost like a messenger and share all the secrets that you have told him to someone else, and that will bring about the trouble. And this reminds me some of the Tibetans who come from Tibet and who come to see me, and when we start discussing, then as and when they start saying something, and after making few statements, they would look all around to ensure that nobody is eavesdropping or listening, and because they are so used to be this kind of thing when they were in Tibet. And we experience this difficulty of appearance and disparity between appearance and reality. Sometimes we see very nice and fresh looking fruits, and then we get very attracted to it and have a bite, and then you find that the fruit is so sour that even you start getting headache sometimes. So this is how you get deceived, by not being able to get the appearance, gap between the appearance and the reality. So when we approach more closer to the meaning of the ultimate reality, then we will not, there will be less chances of being deceived by the appearances. And in fact today, certain facts like that things are momentarily changing, these are actually proved through observation of many changes that we see all around. And that now, for example, if you experiment, say, a flower or say a leaf that you see in front, if you explore the nature of this leaf, then you will see it is subtle nature, and its grosser appearance will disappear. If you go more and more into that, you will always end up finding more and more subtle reality, and then gradually, and in the case of external material object, in this way there is an endless scope for going into the reality of that object. So this is something that is well known to the world, to the whole world. So therefore, when we talk about the true truth, conventional truth, ultimate truth, we are talking simply about that. So this is explained in verse 2, which it says, conventional and ultimate, these are the true truths. And what is ultimate truth is not an object of engagement of the mind, and what that which is an object of engagement of mind is the conventional. So that means ultimate truth is, when it says that the ultimate truth is not an object of engagement of the mind, it means that the ultimate truth is not an object of engagement of ordinary mind or conventional mind, and that which is the object of ordinary conventional mind, that is conventional truth. And when we are lost with the conventional grosser realities, then we are unable to perceive the subtle nature, and therefore ultimate refers to it is ultimate nature. And so in general, such presentations of two truths are found also in non-Buddhist schools of thought. For example, the Samkhyas, they say that the primal substance and the person are the ultimate truth, and the expressions of these are the conventional truth. and the difference lies in the interpretation, in the definition that is being given to these two truths. Now, with regard to the meaning of these last two lines, there are many different ways of explaining it. So therefore, ultimate truth is not the object of engagement of her mind, which has dualistic appearances. And that means ultimate truth is the one which is perceived by a mind that loses the dualistic appearances. And without dualistic appearances, when the mind gets totally absorbed and lost into the ultimate truth, then the ultimate truth is realized. And that which is the object of such a dualistic mind, that is conventional truth. And then according to what is explained in the Madhyamika Avatara, then that which is found by a conventional mind is the conventional truth, and that which is found by a mind that analyzes the ultimate truth is the ultimate truth. And therefore it says that that which is ultimate is not object of engagement of the dualistic mind. The reason is that that which is the direct object of engagement of dualistic mind is the conventional truth. So each of this, the first line explains the meaning of ultimate truth, and the second line explains the meaning of the conventional truth. So therefore this does not mean to say that ultimate truth is not object of any mind. The late Khunu Lama Rinpoche, he interpreted this by saying that the mind here, from the Sanskrit point of view, you will find the usage of the word mind in the fourth verse and also in this second verse. But according to Sanskrit, even though here we have the word mind, they have different meanings. Now, since there is a reality which does not conform to the appearance, and therefore depending upon the state, the superiority of your mind, there will be different ways of presenting things, there will be many different viewpoints, and therefore verse 3 reads that there are the two types of worldly beings are seen, and that is those who are more contemplative and those who are ordinary. Now, all those who are yogis and those who are ordinary. Yogis or contemplatives here refers to those people who do not easily accept what appears to them, but who analyzes all the time about the truth and reality of such a thing. And so therefore the Sanskrit word yogi has been translated by Nanjorpa. The Tibetan word Naljor is a combination of two words, Nal and Jor. Nal means that which is true, and Jor is someone who searches the truth and applies one's mind to that. So from that point of view, the modern scientists, they are also in this kind of category, contemplative. So they analyze. So from a wider point of view, I think that these scientists are also yogis or Neljorpa. And then there is another category who do not make such investigation and analysis, but would simply follow that which comes across, good or bad. And then what is perceived by the ordinary worldly beings, that is harmed and contradicted by the yogis or those who are more contemplative, because these people would say that even though these are accepted like this from an ordinary parlance, but in reality this is not the case, because to such grosser presentations it will be harmed by what is found through analysis investigation. Verse number 4. And now even among the yogis, depending upon the level of their intelligence, those that are higher will harm the viewpoints of the lower ones. Now in the case of the understanding of the mind, if we relate this to the understanding of the mind by the scientists, they have less understanding, because they focus more on analyzing the external material objects, physical objects, and therefore they do not have the capacity to analyze the mind as they have towards the physical objects. And when it comes mind comes to explaining the mind and consciousness, for example, if they say, as is said by the hedonists or charvakas, saying that the mind is nothing but a byproduct of the brain and so on, then in that case it will be difficult to explain certain experiences like remembrance of past lives. And even though there are not many people, but there are people who are able to remember their past lives, and similarly how this whole world came into existence, and there are many areas that we can explore and question. So in those cases it will be difficult to come with a clear answer without accepting and positing the presence of mind and consciousness. And therefore such understandings and presentations of the scientists and so on could be harmed by many ancient non-Buddhist Indian philosophical schools of thought. And now in addition to that, if we accept a self that came from the past life and goes to the next life independent of the psychophysical aggregate, then such a philosophical viewpoint could be harmed, because if you accept such a philosophy, then this would imply that you cannot call a person as young because of his young body, and also you cannot call that person as old in terms of having a young old body, because if there is a permanent unchanging self, then such a self cannot be described from the parlance of changes of the body. So such a viewpoint would be harmed by higher philosophical schools of thought. And even among Buddhists, some of the presentations made by Vaibhashikas are harmed by the philosophical viewpoints of the Sotan Tikas. And therefore when Vasubandhu wrote the Abhidharma Kosha, he made such sarcastic remarks towards the Vaibhashika viewpoint. And therefore when the lower Buddhist schools of thought are scrutinized and analyzed by the higher Buddhist schools of thought, they are harmed, or contradictions are revealed.